Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published in January 2025 by the Geographic Society. I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with this article, What to Eat in Aruba, the Caribbean island where Wahoo is king. Dutch and Portuguese flavors bring international flair to local seafoods on this Caribbean island, from freshly grilled mahi-mahi to citrusy fried shrimp. But save room for clay pot stews and cheese-stuffed pastries. It's by James March. Leaning back on the captain's chair, Sherwin Mueller crosses his scuffed olive-green sandals and steers our trawler out of Aruba's Renaissance Marina. It's 7:30 a.m., and the breeze blowing through the boat's upper deck is merciful on this humid morning, as the marina's stillness gives way to the Caribbean Sea's choppy roll. "I'm the only fisherman in my family," says Sherwin, now in his 11th year at Hats Off Fishing Charters. "My mom worked in the oil refinery, and my dad was a cop. Wearing a stained gray hoodie and floral shorts, the jocular Sherwin exudes calm, while I hope my fragile sea legs don't abandon me. Aruba's a fish-obsessed island, and this expedition is a window into the everyday life of the fisher folk who use the traditional line-caught method. Every hotel and restaurant in Aruba serves fish in one form or another, from succulent deep-sea grouper to small but muscular octopus. When I was young, I used to watch the guys coming in with wahoo and mahi-mahi," Sherwin says, pointing toward the docks. Suddenly, a metallic blue wahoo shoots out of the water, and Sherwin leaps from his chair, spitting commands to his crew below in Aruba's local Creole language, Papiamento. "I scurry down to the chaotic lower deck and am quickly inserted into the boat's fighting chair, like a movie president scrambling into the war room. Reeling in the struggling wahoo takes around 5 minutes, but feels like an eternity, with my right arm limp and my gray T-shirt caked in sweat. 'It's a workout, right?' says Sherwin afterwards, laughing. I tell him breathlessly that I'll remember this slog with some reverence when I sit down for dinner later. Aruba is set on the Caribbean Sea's southernmost flank, barely 15 miles from the Venezuelan coast. The island is just 20 miles from end to end, and its 18th century capital, Aranjestad, was once a thriving merchant city, but these days is a breezy, pastel-splashed pit stop for the mountainous cruise ships that heave into its busy port every week. Possibly inspired by the opening line of the Beach Boys' 1988 earworm track Kokomo, "Aruba, Jamaica, oh, I wanna take ya," the island seems to have been canonized as the Caribbean escape du jour for Americans. Aruba's tourist heart has a slick western feel, and its streets are well furnished with McDonald's, KFC, and Wendy's. But travel beyond the garish Americana of Aranjestad's port and West Coast Palm Beach's well-heeled strip, and Aruba couldn't be more different, its unusual desert climate creating rolling, cactus-strewn trails. Seafood graces practically every menu on this multinational island, but locals hold an unabashed love for cheese and deep-fried soul food. I stopped by Huchada, a family-run roadside bakery, with a patient morning queue extending outside from its well-stocked counters. I order a host of favorites, including the ubiquitous cheese pastiche. The small, warm, half-moon pasty, filled with melted Gouda cheese, is an unctuous delight, with the subtle sweetness of the pastry balancing the saltiness emanating from the cheese. In Papiamento, we say, sin vibo no tin fiesta. No egg, no party, explains my guide, Jonathan, as I bite into a vibo yena, a soft deviled egg garnished with black pepper, salt, and oregano. There's a delicious bitter tang to its creamy texture. Aruba's soupy humidity ramps up by lunchtime, and the sea breeze at our next stop, coastal hotspot Zierover, feels like a blessing. This place draws in knowing crowds from right across the island, despite a southern location that's far from the traditional tourist drag. Here they bring out food in baskets and encourage eating with your hands. It's liberating, and I snatch at succulent cuts of mahi-mahi loin, tender ovals of fried plantain, and more pre-peeled shrimp that is decent or indeed necessary. That evening in Aranjestad, Nathalie D. May waits for me beneath a swirling ceiling fan at Taste My Aruba, her restaurant on lively Wilhelminastraat, one of several local food venues that hosted the island's new culinary festival, Authentico, when it made its debut in October 2024. The colorful Portuguese-tiled patio of this century-old building is draped in festooned lights, while the garden is awash with fragrant thyme, basil, mint, lemongrass, lavender, and rosemary. I opened here 3 years ago, she says, smiling through her thick-framed black glasses. I started under a tree down the road with four tables and an induction stove. I sold sandwiches, but they didn't really work. Then one day a guy came over, since I was close to the harbor, and sold me 7 kilos of wahoo, and the rest is history. I toast the restaurant's haphazard origin story with a smoky old-fashioned and learn that Nathalie is a food obsessive who will harness any method to provide the freshest produce for her customers. Recently growing produce in hydroponic greenhouses has taken off. Nathalie's lettuce comes from greenhouses run by local Jake Arends, while Aranjestad tattooist Rachel Peterson provides oyster, shiitake, and lion's head mushrooms grown at her urban farm, Pharmacure Fungi. All my fish is line-caught, she says. I have my own fishermen. It's a relationship. They're my family. I'm served a buttery tuna tatari on a bed of fresh avocado, before a shredded stoba de cabrito is brought out in a small clay pot. Despite the year-round heat, Arubans love stews, and this hearty goat variety is rich, chewy, and given a fiery kick by a drop of hot pica de papaya sauce. We don't have one such thing as Aruban food. We're a melting pot of cultures, Nathalie explains, before discussing Aruba's love for Italian polenta, Indonesian satay sauce, and Colombian beans. We even have black pudding, she says, with a staccato laugh. I love black pudding. My chef makes a beautiful black pudding croquet. For those with the time and passion, foraging is also an option in this challenging landscape. One man with both is Frank Kelly, a chef known by all as Taki. Inked in tattoos of sketches by his children, and hopping with bubbling energy when we meet, the gregarious Taki is a Reuben of Colombian and Irish heritage. It's hard to imagine that he once worked in a bank. These days he tours the island, scavenging on land and fishing at sea. In my family, I'm the only one who fishes and loves the water, he says, echoing Sherwin Mueller. My mom and dad weren't supportive when I started surfing because I'm an only child. I am their everything. During a serpentine drive into Aruba's parched heart, we pick up bitter fungi growing on the umbrella-like kawihi tree. Sweet red fruits from the breba cactus and cactus flower and citrus flowers from somebody's front garden. In between pontificating on mortality, you have to ride life until the wheels fall off, and stopping for drinks at the various Chinese supermarkets scattered through Aruba's inner suburbs, Taki brings us to the island's rocky south coast, where we scoop up natural salt left behind by the seawater following evaporation. Anyone can gather this salt, but nobody does because it's easier to go to the supermarket, he says, as we amble back to the car. Taki reappears at my hotel that evening, armed with a small barbecue. Moonlight gives the clouds above a milky white glow, while the wind ruffles the swaying palms. He boils a gentle consommé using the salt and seaweed we'd found earlier, before finishing with tender pink shark and octopus he caught the day before. I'm grateful he didn't need to do all of this. For us on our island, giving you a lot of food is giving you love, he says, sharing a local rum with me. It is equivalent to love, and I like that. That's the end of the article. The title was What to Eat in Aruba, the Caribbean Island Where Wahoo is King, written by James March. The next article is titled These Ants Are Saving Our Forests by Spraying Acid Everywhere. The engineering and defensive skills of redwood ants help the endangered species transcend its small stature in the natural world. Written by Eric Alt. Wildlife photographer Ingo Arndt discovered his first enormous ant mound as a child, exploring the forest with his father near their home in Germany almost 50 years ago. They were bird watching and came around a bend in a densely wooded area when there it was, a 5-foot-tall mound, jutting upward like a large stalagmite. The mound was covered with a thick layer of spruce needles and throngs of tiny red ants. Arndt wanted to investigate more closely, but a very particular smell suggested he rethink that impulse. The air felt thick and pungent, stinging his nostrils like vinegar. All my life, he says, I could remember that smell. As an adult, Arndt has spent much of his career traveling to photograph animals, like the pumas of Patagonia and kangaroos in Australia. Several years ago, he moved to the German countryside with his wife. While hiking through the region's pine forests, the surroundings rekindled his fascination with the mounds and their armies of ultra-small engineers. How did insects, roughly a quarter of an inch long, build such huge structures? And why did they emanate that astringent odor? Arndt now had the tools and experience to seek answers to his questions. Outfitted with a high-resolution camera and macro lenses that allow you to focus on small objects up close, he began photographing the mounds and sharing his imagery with researchers for a scientific perspective. It turns out the mound makers were indeed special. They were red wood ants, scientifically classified as a group within the genus Formica, one of the smallest of all so-called keystone species. Among conservationists, keystone species such as elephants and sharks are watched closely because their behaviors affect so many aspects of their ecosystem that if they disappeared, it would struggle to adapt. Red wood ants are typically found in Eurasia's temperate and boreal forests, but in recent decades, more nests have been disappearing as the forests have fallen victim to logging, urbanization, and wildfires, as well as drought and higher temperatures that have become more frequent with climate change. This has led several countries across the ants' range, including Germany, to designate them as a protected species by law. Today, Arndt's photo quest has taken on new meaning. His images, which he's been producing for the past 2 years, put on display these creatures' fascinating ability to forge a multitude of symbiotic relationships across a variety of plant and animal species. In doing so, he's revealed the wonders of a hidden insect world. The massive nests consist of two parts, one above ground and one below, which redwood ants create by both burrowing into the earth and gathering needles, leaves, bark, and twigs. As they rise, each mound gains new entrances and corridors, supporting anywhere from 30,000 to upwards of 16 million insects, the largest above-ground nests of any ant species in the world. To learn more about this concealed society, Arndt enlisted the help of entomologist Bernhard Seifert of the Senckenberg Natural History Museum's Research Institute in Frankfurt, and zoologist Jürgen Taus, professor emeritus at the Julius Maximilian University of Würzburg. The researchers helped explain how Arndt's images showed the ants directing life within the forest in surprising ways. For instance, the ants generate formic acid in a venom gland at the rear of their abdomen. As they build a nest, the ants will gather tree resin, which has been shown to possess antimicrobial properties, and spray it with their acid, which has its own antimicrobial properties. The result is a more potent agent that the ants place throughout the structure to fight against bacterial and fungal pathogens. Formic acid also powers the species' pest control role. The fluid can be weaponized to take down other insects, like wood-boring beetles, one of the most destructive vermin in spruce forests. The fighting tactic, Seifert explains, involves biting them and then spraying formic acid into the wounds. Reducing the number of beetles that weaken and destroy trees improves conditions for aphids living in them. The ants milk the aphids to excrete honeydew, which becomes their primary food source. Using camera traps, Arndt also captured larger animals lining up to get sprayed voluntarily. A rare image shows a Eurasian jay landing on top of a mound and calmly flattening out its tail to allow the ants to crawl up and attack. The ants spray the jays as an enemy, says Taz. While the birds appear unharmed, the toxin is powerful enough to disperse or kill parasites, such as mites and lice, that they carry. For many bird species, this behavior helps them stay healthy too. Some uninvited guests that are willing to wreak alongside the community have gained more benefits, as social insects, ants organize colonies and form complex societies, but they also cohabitate with a wide variety of species, including mites, spiders, and flies, within their nests. One trick is that some of these interlopers may have grown up already doused in a familiar scent. If a leaf beetle drops its eggs on or near the mound, the workers may inadvertently bring the eggs into the nest while collecting materials. The larvae actually live inside it, Arndt explains. The eggs, then the larvae, and eventually the pupae, all smell like the nest. That's how they elude their host's detection and exploit the shelter to survive. In one study, researchers confirmed that, on average, more than a dozen different species can be found within a single mound. Arndt's project highlights the strange and amazing ways these often overlooked creatures are influencing the action around them. While he did his best to avoid disrupting the protected species, the ants at times had other ideas, and they'd hitch a ride back with him. "I'll be out at dinner, and they show up and walk over my pants," he says, laughing at the memory, "but I always try and bring everybody back to the nest. The forest needs their collective power." And that's the end of the article titled, "These Ants Are Saving Our Forests by Spraying Acid Everywhere," by Eric Ault. This article's title is "The Famous Bonsai Forest That Lives in Washington, D.C." There's no author cited for the article. The ancient art of bonsai may look deceptively simple, but its practice requires care, contemplation, and consistency over long periods of time, especially if you're growing an entire miniature forest, like the famous living artifact known as Goshen, pronounced Goshen. This bonsai was started more than 70 years ago when Japanese-American bonsai artist John Naka cut the top off a mature juniper tree and planted it in a pot. Over the next two decades, he surrounded it with 10 more trees, one to honor each of his grandchildren. He named this miniature forest Goshen, which means protector of the spirit in Japanese. Today, Goshen is on display at the National Bonsai and Penjing Museum, part of the National Arboretum in Washington, D.C., with the important distinction of being one of the world's best-known bonsai arrangements. Naka died in 2004 at the age of 89, but spent the last decades of his life teaching curators how to continue to care for the forest according to his vision. "For a tree to be healthy, you have to let it grow out and gain strength," says Michael James, curator at the museum. "And when you do that, it gets out of shape. It doesn't look like a bonsai anymore, so then you have to cut it back. That means no bonsai is ever truly finished. With proper attention, Goshen could live on for years." While bonsai is a historic Japanese art form dating back centuries, early artists were likely inspired by the Chinese practice of Penjing, which can be traced to the Han Dynasty some 2,000 years ago. Penjing involves creating miniature potted landscapes that can include trees, rocks, water, human and animal figurines, and other features. But what sets bonsai arrangements apart is their sole focus on maintaining small trees with specific techniques for shaping that allow them to resemble much larger specimens. Naka, who was born in Fort Lupton, Colorado, discovered the practice after he moved at age 8 with his parents to their home country of Japan. There, his grandfather introduced him to the art of bonsai. Naka returned to Colorado in his 20s and eventually settled in L.A., where he helped found the California Bonsai Society. In the decades that followed, he became known nationally and worldwide as both an artist and a teacher. Naka gave Goshin to the National Bonsai and Penjing Museum in 1984. Today, Goshin stands out among Naka's bonsai designs because of how large its trees are. It stands nearly 5 feet at its tallest point, and how closely Naka was able to place them together, this is particularly difficult to do without over-pruning the roots, which can cause the trees to wither and die. He would come over every year and help the museum curators work on Goshin, James says, about Naka's dedication to teaching the art to others. We're trying to preserve it as he would have. And that's the end of the article, The Famous Bonsai Forest That Lives in Washington, D.C. And that's the end of the broadcast today. This has been the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. All the articles were published in January of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming. And if you missed an article you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio. On the next screen, click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.